Just ahead of his remarks in Iowa, Bush was scheduled to tour the facilities at Sears Manufacturing, which would serve as the backdrop for his speech. He wasn't scheduled to take any questions, but during the flight to Davenport, I'd learned from Advance Director Brian Montgomery that the press pool would be just a few feet away during the tour. I needed to alert the president to the story and make sure he was prepared in case a reporter tried to shout out a question to him. I cornered the president in a little holding area just outside the manufacturing area. "Mr. President, I need to talk to you," I said. Bush glanced at me a little impatiently. He was focused on the tour, and as always, eager to stay on schedule. "What do you got?" he asked. "Sir, there is no plan to take questions this morning, but the press will be pretty close to you on the tour. You need to know that they may try to ask you about Larry Lindsey's comments in today's Wall Street Journal." "What did he say?" the president asked. "He said that war with Iraq could cost between $100 billion and $200 billion, I replied. Clearly irritated, the president turned his head to one side and grimaced. He was steamed, as I'd expected. "Why did he say that?" the president asked rather pointedly, glancing back at me. "I don't know," I said. "He was talking to a reporter, and I think he just blurted it out in response to a question. I already told the press it is too early to speculate about a decision that has yet to be made." "Has anyone spoken to him?" the president asked. "Yes, sir," I said. "Andy was supposed to." "It's unacceptable," Bush continued, his voice rising. "He shouldn't be talking about that, and let them know I don't plan on answering any questions." By them, he meant the press. "I already have," I responded. By then, Bush was already exiting the holding area to begin the tour. I followed right behind. The president managed to avoid any questions about Lindsey's loose cannon comments that morning. Within 4 months, Larry was gone, having resigned from the administration as part of a reshaping of the president's economic team. His comments on the cost of the war did not help. Larry, a highly regarded economist, had violated a basic principle of the Bush White House. The president doesn't like anyone getting out in front of him. It's his job to make the news, not anyone else's, unless authorized as part of the script. And making news by going off message compounds the crime and makes it something close to unforgivable, particularly at that crucial early stage as we were just beginning the massive marketing campaign. As a White House spokesman, I appreciated the need for a clear, controlled message. In a world of 24-hour news cycles, the media bombard their audiences with thousands of competing messages conveyed in countless words and images. The chances of getting any single idea through that cacophony are slim. When you wield the bully pulpit of the White House and the giant megaphone of the presidency, it is easier to set the agenda and get your ideas covered. But it still requires a coherent message and repetition of it for any concept to sink in and be fully grasped. If an administration hopes to communicate with the public effectively, it has to develop simple, straightforward, and consistent messages that connect with people's interests, concerns, and needs. Then it must find a variety of ways to make those messages newsworthy so they can be hammered home to the public. Otherwise, what the president wants to say will get lost in the ether, and with it, his chance to shape events, influence society, and, hopefully, make a positive difference in people's lives. So generally speaking, I not only understood and respected the Bush administration's emphasis on staying on message, but supported it and worked to help shape it and spread it as part of my job. But today, as I look back on the campaign we waged to sell the Iraq War to the American people, a campaign I participated in, though I didn't play a major role in shaping it, I see more clearly the downside of applying modern campaign tactics to matters of grave historical import. Reflecting on that period has helped crystallize my understanding of the permanent campaign, with its destructive excesses, and how Washington, in its current state of partisan warfare, functions on mutual deception. The picture isn't pretty. The vast majority of our elected officials are good people, but they are caught up in an endless effort to manipulate public opinion to their advantage. Driven by partisan interest, they engage in deception, whether intentionally or not, and I believe in most cases the deception is in fact unintentional or subconscious. It is all part of the political propaganda effort to advance one's causes. Then the media go to work, focused on covering the conflicts and controversies, the winners and losers of the perpetual campaign. The press amplifies the talking points of one or both parties in its coverage, thereby spreading distortions, half-truths, and occasionally outright lies in an effort to seize the limelight and have something or someone to pick on. And by overemphasizing conflict and controversy, and by reducing complex and important issues to convenient black-and-white storylines and 7-second soundbites, the media exacerbate the problem, thereby making it incredibly hard, even for well-intentioned leaders, to clarify and correct the misunderstandings and oversimplifications that dominate the political conversation. Finally, it becomes much more difficult for the general public to decipher the more important truths amid all the conflict, controversy, and negativity. For some partisans, that is fine because they believe they can maneuver better in such a highly politicized environment to accomplish their objectives. But the destructive potential of such excessively partisan warfare would later crystallize my thinking. In the fall of 2002, Bush and his White House were engaging in a carefully orchestrated campaign to shape and manipulate sources of public approval to our advantage. We'd done much the same on other issues, tax cuts and education, to great success. But war with Iraq was different. Beyond the irreversible human cost and the substantial financial price, the decision to go to war and the way we went about selling it would ultimately lead to increased polarization and intensified partisan warfare. Our lack of candor and honesty in making the case for war would later provoke a partisan response from our opponents that, in its own way, further distorted and obscured a more nuanced reality. Another cycle of deception would cloud the public's ability to see larger, underlying important truths that are critical to understand in order to avoid the same problems in the future. And through it all, the media would serve as complicit enablers. Their primary focus would be on covering the campaign to sell the war, rather than aggressively questioning the rationale for war or pursuing the truth behind it. The White House knew the national media would cover its arguments for war, even if the underlying evidence was a little shaky. Questions might be raised, but the administration had the biggest platform, especially when something as dramatic and controversial as war was at stake. And the public is generally inclined to believe what the White House says, or at least give it the benefit of the doubt, until the watchdog media proves it is unreliable. But in this case, the media would neglect their watchdog role, focusing less on truth and accuracy and more on whether the campaign was succeeding. Was the president winning or losing the argument? How were Democrats responding? What were the electoral implications? What did the polls say? And the truth about the actual nature of the threat posed by Saddam, the right way to confront it, and the possible risk of military conflict would get largely left behind, at least until after Bush had gained the necessary support to begin the war, at which point public support for our troops in harm's way would kick in. There were exceptions. A handful of reporters aggressively questioned the administration's chief rationale and focused on the necessity and realities of war. But they were unable to either change the primary focus of the media as the aggressive campaign to win public opinion raged, or slow Bush's determined march to war. During the lead-up to the war, I served as Deputy White House Press Secretary. My role did not center on Iraq or even the effort to sell it. I spent most of my time tending to non-Iraq press issues. At times, however, I filled in for Ari Fleischer and consequently participated in the campaign to sell the war, or shape and manipulate sources of public opinion to our advantage. Like many Americans at the time, I was uncertain about the necessity for war and the new doctrine of preemption that was being used to push us toward it. I wondered why we needed to move so fast toward military confrontation. But I trusted the president and the policymakers on his national security team. They'd received almost universal accolades for their swift yet measured response to 9/11, especially the war in Afghanistan. Now, most of them believed the Iraq threat was serious, and that played a large role in my willingness to go along with, if not necessarily wholeheartedly embrace, the decision to confront Saddam militarily. After all, they had full access to the intelligence and an intimate knowledge of Saddam Hussein and his regime. I did not. So, also like most Americans, I was inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt unless and until they proved unworthy of it. The campaign to sell the war didn't begin in earnest until the fall of 2002. But, as I would later come to learn, President Bush had decided to confront the Iraqi regime several months earlier. Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz all saw 9/11 as an opportunity to go after Saddam Hussein, take out his regime, eliminate a threat, and make the Middle East more secure. And Bush agreed. As he told Bob Woodward in an interview late in 2003, he felt the United States first needed to take care of Afghanistan, to topple the Taliban, and take away al-Qaeda's safe haven there. It was a first-things-first approach, with Iraq always in the president's and his national security team's sights as part of their broad view of the war on terrorism. When and why Bush made the decision to go to war in Iraq are probably the most fundamental questions to explore in order to understand the way his administration went about selling it to the American people.